Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Support for the Mark Steiner Show comes from the Maryland State Education Association. The Maryland Dream Act makes sure kids who graduated from a Maryland high school and whose parents have paid taxes for at least 3 years can pay in-state tuition. Investing in education of our kids benefits our state, our economy, and the young people who will get a shot at achieving their dreams. On November 6th, voters get to determine if some of our Maryland students can seek a higher education. It's important to vote. More information about ballot question 4 can be found at educatingmarylandkids.org. We're about to have a conversation with Charles Faddis, retired CIA operations officer and author, currently finishing his third novel, Kaffa, about a fictional biological weapons attack on the United States. And after that conversation, we'll be joined by Bill Fletcher. Sam Faddis, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Yes.
Hi, you're there.
I am here.
Welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So, Sam, we are going to take two very different looks at this. And you, as someone who was in the CIA, who had a son who fought in Afghanistan in the Marines, who led a secret unit in Iraq even before the war began, you've commented on these things a lot on the show over the years. And I'm just curious just to really reflect back from that moment 11 years ago, that moment before the 11 years ago, to where we are now and what you have come out with. What has changed in Sam Faddis? What has Sam Faddis, the former CIA operative, learned in these 11 years?
Well, for me, Mark, the experience of the attack itself is eerily similar to a lot of Americans in that I was, going about my business, saw the news that the first plane had hit and so forth, and then a second aircraft went into the World Trade Center, and like everybody else in the country realized what was going on. But I had spent, years and years and years before that working counterterrorism and was aware that we were already at war and just trying to pretend like we weren't, effectively. So from that moment on, for myself and a lot of other guys in the agency, it was there was a lot of sort of, now we finally get to get at this threat that we've been asking people to let us get at for a long time. So there is that sense that we confronted a threat that, we had been attempting to ignore for a long time. I have to say there is, like a lot of other people, though, a little bit of reservation that I think, the pendulum has swung too far to the other side after.
What's your take, on what Kurt Eichenwald has been writing for Vanity Fair, and he's got this book coming out, or is out, 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars, where he goes into what happened before 9/11 and the CIA's warning of the White House that something was afoot, but nothing was done. And part of it, he even says, that many in the Central Intelligence Agency where when they told about this report of a group present in the United States playing a terrorist act, no one listened to them. They wanted to kind of head for the door, not to be blamed for what happened, and they were kind of tearing their hair out. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there's a lot of this discussion about things that were and were not said to the White House and other policymakers prior to 9/11, and some of that, I think, goes too far. I mean, clearly the agency did not have specific warning of and specific knowledge of this attack. So any suggestions that they did and they knew anything like that, that's erroneous. But it is absolutely true that the nature overall, the greater picture of the threat that was gathering and what was happening and that we were had in fact already been hit multiple times by al-Qaeda, two embassies, a U.S. warship. All of that picture had been painted for years and years. And all operators that were in the field had been for a long time asking for permission to sort of take the gloves off and go at this threat.
The first time we met was because of the book that you wrote about the operation that you led into Iraq before the war even began. A time when you also felt like, in some ways, you and others were hung out to dry, but that this is in going into Iraq. And I wonder now, reflecting on that time and reflecting on this war, this war that that well, we lost a lot of people in this war. We lost 2,996 people on 9/11. Over almost 3,200 soldiers have been killed in Iraq. We don't know how many hundreds of thousands were really lost in Iraq in terms of civilians. 15,000 civilians, at least in Afghanistan. 3,000 or so killed by drones. 42,000 killed in Pakistan from terrorist attacks.
Hey Mark, yeah. I apologize, but I'm getting some kind of talk over on the phone. Can I call you back?
Yes, you can.
Okay, I was listening to two voices.
Yeah, I can hear it too. So you can join us here while we're waiting for Sam to call back at 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888. Your own reflections on this day and what it means. We'll be talking with Sam Faddis, former CIA operative, who's been guesting the show many times. Very interesting perspective. We'll be hearing from Bill Fletcher, past president of TransAfrica, after Sam, with his reflections on 9/11 and what it means for America and American society. You can join us here at 410-319-8888, or you can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And I think Sam is back here on the line. No? 410-319-8888. And we'll get to your calls. This is when you think about this day and the thousands of people who have died, who were killed on 9/11, who have died in the war in Iraq, who have died in the war in Afghanistan, not just American troops, but Afghan people, Pakistani people. Is it Sam is back? Sam, hi.
Talking only to you.
Good. All right. 410-319-8888. So, Sam, what I was asking before, just your reflections on all of that and that the sense or nonsense that war in Iraq meant from the beginning.
Yeah, well, I think clearly the war in Iraq was a, as far as the war on terror, if we use that phrase anyway, the response to al-Qaeda and to Islamic extremism, the war in Iraq was clearly a diversion and didn't have much of anything to do with that threat. Those are clearly apples and oranges. As I think you know, I volunteered for that assignment to take the first team in, which probably is a reflection on my level of intelligence. But
but go ahead.
I volunteered for that assignment, and I was, proud to serve there and proud of the guys I served with, but walked out of there after that invasion completely disgusted with what had transpired and with the unwillingness of the administration to, to face reality. They just had their own little vision of the world and their own preconceptions as to what was going on, and they didn't seem to want to actually listen to anybody on the ground that would disturb those fantasies. And you're absolutely right. A lot of people paid a huge price. And it, not just the fact that we invaded, but everything we did after we invaded and how we handled the occupation was done in a way that a lot of Americans paid with their lives for.
So, Sam, in the time we have left, I reflect a little bit on what you think we should do and what this tells us, what the threat really is from your perspective now. With al-Qaeda or any other terrorist organizations in the world, and how you respond to that?
Yeah, this is what, the way I look at it, Mark, is that I think prior to 9/11, it was clear that as a country, we were effectively trying to pretend that we were not facing a threat. And we lost two embassies in East Africa, and we almost lost a U.S. warship, and we were attacked multiple times. And we pretended like that wasn't happening. And it then clear to me that post 9/11, we swung dramatically too far to the other end of the spectrum. And I think what we need is a prudent middle course where we recognize that there are threats we have to deal with, but where we are much more judicious, if I can use that word, about where and when we become involved and have a much clearer idea of why.
So what does that mean in terms of what you think that well, let's get a quick caller in here. Steve, you're on the air. Hi, Steve, you're on the air. I guess that's not working. There must be some issues with our phone lines. I'm sorry. But so very quickly, Charles, just coming back to Sam, coming back to where we are. mean, how does America respond now? I mean, what do you think should be the response to what we face on the planet? Clearly, Afghanistan war is going to end in terms of American and NATO troops coming back. The Iraq war has wound down. What should be our response to what we face?
Broadcast on top of my phone line.
Say again? You're still hearing that feedback on your phone line? Okay. Well, I just want to thank Sam Faddis for joining us, and it's been great to have him on the air. Sorry we couldn't get this, or this kind of got in the way, and you guys couldn't call in here either at 410-319-8888 and get your thoughts in the air about this very special day, a day I think that everybody will remember who was alive at that moment when that happened, and we can't forget it, what it did for us. I remember it very well being there as the Public Radio Program Directors Association was in Baltimore and we were hosting them, and WNYC was here, which was the New York Public Radio, and their station was literally right next to the Twin Towers. As you scramble that day to make sure people were alive in New York and our brothers and sisters in this business, and it's just something you won't ever forget. But how we responded as a nation is the issue that we really have to think about and address. And that's what we try to reflect on with Sam Faddis. Conversation we're about to hear, we're going to bring up to you now, is with Bill Fletcher, Jr. Bill Fletcher is a former president of TransAfrica. Bill Fletcher is a man who writes for The Nation magazine and is one of our leading journalists and thinkers. And we're looking forward to hearing his thoughts coming up in the next minute here on the Mark Steiner Show. And on the way there, I'm going to remind you that to join WEAA and Amy Goodman, who is host of Democracy Now!, for a private reception and book signing for the upcoming release of her new book, The Silenced Majority, Stories of Uprisings, Occupations, Resistance, and Hope by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan. It's Saturday, September 29th, 4 to 5:30 p.m. at the UB Blake Cultural Center. Tickets include a reception, copy of the book, and a photo with Amy and Dennis. Space is limited. Tickets are available at the WEA Studios right here, or you can call 443-885-2075. That's 443-885-2075. More information is also available at weaa.org. We now take a break and come back with our interview with Bill Fletcher. Bill Fletcher, Jr., on his thoughts and reflections on 9/11, 11 years later. Bill Fletcher is an editorial member of blackcommentator.com. He's a visiting scholar with CUNY's Graduate Center in New York, senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and the immediate past president of TransAfrica Forum, and the co-author of Solidarity Divided. Of course, also, he's a writer for The Nation magazine. Bill, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
I'm really glad to be on the program. Thanks.
So, Bill, talk a bit about, in a very broader sense, as people think about 9/11, it's interesting that people say it's been the smallest group of people to turn out for a memorial service since that tragedy occurred 11 years ago. But just reflecting on what that moment meant to you at the moment, but also what it's done to America and in the last 11 years, how it has changed us.
Well, it changed us in so many ways. I mean, on September 10th, we had a mediocre president who was not doing well in the polls. And September 12th, he ended up becoming elevated by the mainstream media into being a hero. The fear and shock that resulted from 9/11 led to a period of incredible repression, beginning with the combination of the Patriot Act, the disappearance of many individuals, unexplained at the time, the event, obviously the bombing and eventual invasion of Afghanistan and then Iraq, and there was a head of steam that was built up as a result of the 9/11 terrorist attacks that became, for a few years, almost irresistible to challenge the aggressiveness of the U.S. internationally and domestically, led to all sorts of allegations that people were soft on terrorism or other things. And during that period, the move towards greater authoritarianism in the United States certainly increased. I think that another aspect of the terrorist attacks is that they touched so many of us in different ways, either knowing people that died directly or, as in my case, someone who died indirectly as a result of the attacks, or now it's coming out about the various cancers that were produced as a result of the destruction of the Twin Towers that people are living with, people that were in the vicinity or the rescue personnel. I mean, 9/11 has not gone away. It is with us. And I think probably will for a very, very long time. I guess the other thing that I'd add here is that in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, there was what I'd call a World War II paradigm that was imposed on the situation that I think was completely inaccurate and very unhelpful in terms of understanding what had just happened to us. I mean, people were acting as if Al-Qaeda was the equivalent of the Japanese Zeros that attacked Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor was about a nation attacking another nation for a whole host of reasons. The 9/11 was about an outfit of criminal clerical fascists who carried out a series of attacks. It was a network. And the response by the United States to this attack by a network, at least by the Bush administration, was to attempt almost to turn it into a conventional war, which is why the invasion of Afghanistan, which was very poorly thought through, was a substitute for the real hard work that's necessary in tracking down and squashing a criminal terrorist organization.
Bill, you said a couple of things I think is important to explore, because sometimes there's a rift and a disconnect between some progressive thought and how the mainstream media, at least, addresses issues for the greater public. And I just want to tackle a couple of those that you raised. After the attack on the Twin Towers and the attack on the United States by Al-Qaeda as a criminal group, as you describe it, we had this this trumped-up war against Iraq, and we also attacked Afghanistan, which is the Taliban in control that we're giving refuge to. Al-Qaeda, which is the reason, the excuse to go into Afghanistan. But I wonder then, how should a country like ours, any nation, respond to the kind of attack that took place on 9/11? I think most people might agree that and still questioning why we were in Iraq in the first place. What was that really about?
Right.
Even in that context, what should have been our response, do you think?
I think that the response would have been something that was very unglamorous. There was an immense amount of detective work, much has been done along these lines since, actually. But detective work of tracking down the network and pursuing it and cutting it to pieces. Now, when you're dealing with a network, as in something like a guerrilla war, using conventional techniques, as the United States certainly learned in Vietnam, conventional techniques don't particularly work. You know, if you're fighting a guerrilla band, sending in a tank does not necessarily resolve the situation. When you're fighting a criminal network, whether it's the Sicilian Mafia or whether it's Al-Qaeda, bombing, carrying out bombing and invasions don't make sense. I mean, the bombing and invasion of Afghanistan would made about as much sense as the idea of bombing and occupying Sicily in order to get rid of the Sicilian mafia. That's not the way you go after a network. You have to make use of, as I mentioned, detective work. You have to make use of electronic surveillance. There's a number of things that are, again, not glamorous, but the Bush administration was looking for an immediate response to show that the United States could not be pushed around. And they certainly used the attack to as a pretext for going after Iraq, which was their principal target. So that's the thing that we'd have to accept, that when you're dealing with a criminal outfit, conventional war just simply doesn't apply. And what it actually does, as we found in Afghanistan and now in Pakistan, is that it actually alienates the people that we really want to win over. The people in Afghanistan, clearly, or large numbers of them, were not happy with the Taliban at all. But they became less and less happy with the NATO intervention and the impact that it was having on their villages and towns.
And I think much of that is true. I mean, I think that what we're facing here is, I mean, in America is something that people are still trying to put their hands on to figure out what we should be doing, because al-Qaeda is still seen as this great threat. And if it's not al-Qaeda, then it has to do with the great divide on the planet now between what Americans see as this fundamentalist Muslim opposition to the West and even to their own regimes that are touching in some ways through a broad political spectrum, a lot of the hearts and minds of people. Witness the election in Egypt. And so that's what I think we've gotten so confused about.
We have. We've gotten – I mean, that's a very, very important point that you're making, because, you see, I think that there is such a lack of sophistication when it comes to understanding what's going on in Middle East, North Africa, and South Asia, and Central Asia, that people paint with one brush. You have within the Arab and Muslim world various political tendencies that range from secular nationalists and communists to Islamists. And within the Islamists, there are different tendencies. For example, the government of Turkey is currently an Islamist government. It has nothing in common with al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda represents a particular wing within Islamism, and it's closer, I would closely align it to fascists. Islamism as a political current, I would not identify as fascist. But the problem is that after 9/11, there was, again, this assumption that all of these groups were essentially the same, that they were all hostile to us. And it comes from this deeply rooted Islamophobia within this country. You know, a failure to really appreciate what are the differences, what's the impetus for the rise of these different movements, who is behind them. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, for example, is conservative, but it is not what you could define as a fascist movement. It is conservative, and it is often at odds with more progressive and left-wing forces in Egypt. But that doesn't put them in the camp of the al-Qaeda. And so when we look at the situation, this is what led to these very peculiar analyses of Iraq, that, for example, the suggestion that Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda were somehow in bed with one another,
right,
was completely absurd.
Right.
You know, just understanding who Saddam Hussein was and how much al-Qaeda actually hated him, and that al-Qaeda was based among a certain segment of the Muslim community that was vehemently against any kind of secular forces. I mean, it was just really absurd. Or suggestions that there was a collaboration between the Iranians and al-Qaeda was even more absurd, given that right before 9/11, Iran and Afghanistan were on the verge of war, and that Iran actually supported the U.S.-NATO invasion of Afghanistan. But no one is talking about that. They act as if none of that actually happened.
And we're still seeing that. I mean, right now we're looking at, I mean, when you look at the aftermath of Iraq, and before we come back to our own country to examine what's happened to us internally, when you look at what's going on right now in Afghanistan and Iraq, I mean, the situation in Syria with Iran funneling arms to the Assad regime, which they want to keep going. The United States acts as if it doesn't want Assad there, but it's not doing much on the other side or any side, really. It doesn't appear to be anyway. And it just shows, A, how Iraq is politically not in that after all these years of war, Iraq is playing an independent role the way it wants to on its own, other than the oil. And then you've got Afghanistan, where the United States and NATO seem to say we're going to withdraw. And there's a huge debate inside of Afghanistan over what that withdrawal is going to mean.
Correct.
You know, some people say, yes, we want America out, but others are fearful of what's going to happen next. I mean, this is both Iraq and Afghanistan have unleashed a great uncertainty inside of those worlds, especially in the Islamic world.
And each time the U.S. carries out a military invasion, whether it's Afghanistan, Iraq, or our intervention, aerial intervention in Libya, there are unintended consequences that ripple throughout the region. And yet you would figure that after a few of these, that someone would stop and say, well, wait a minute, maybe we need to be a little bit more careful. But here we go again with the discussions about the potential attack on Iran by either Israel or the United States. Very few people are outside of the Pentagon, which is very much opposed to such an attack, are saying that this is absolutely absurd, that this would have the potential of unleashing a regional war. And no one is ready for that, least Israel, and certainly not the United States. You know, so this lack of historical foundation and this painting of the world the way we want to see it is what constantly gets the United States into trouble.
So before we run, I wanted to kind of reflect for a minute on America and
sure.
and what you think has happened to us since 9/11 that put us together so closely after this attack, which happens to any nation or nationality under attack, often comes together and says, okay, you're attacking us, we're going to stand together, and that becomes this immediate response. It can either go on because the leadership takes it beyond that or it doesn't. But what has happened beyond that? I mean, you talked earlier about your fear of increasing kind of authoritarianism, I think is the word you used.
Correct.
Inside of our own country.
Well, the let's all stand together lasted, I don't know, maybe a day, maybe 2 days. And then the Bush administration manipulated it. And when they did, in leading up to the attack on Afghanistan and eventually against Iraq, they blew a tremendous opportunity. It was also during that time that there were incredible attacks on workers as various segments of the economy started to suffer, and employers, particularly in the airline industry, used the 9/11 attacks and the recession that took place as a pretext for moving against workers. So the goodwill that might have been there evaporated. But the other part of what happened after 9/11 was an uptake in Islamophobia and this climate of constant fear. You know, these various alerts, the yellow alert, the orange alert, et cetera, the constant fear that something was going to happen, this fear in rural areas of the United States, for example, that they would be attacked. When the likelihood of them being attacked was about as likely as me going up in a starship. and yet people, they felt this fear very, very deeply. The administration did nothing to help people deal with that fear other than to promote various forms of jingoism. And so I think that we suffered a great deal in the aftermath of 9/11 by both of those factors, the uptake of fear as well as the uptake in Islamophobia. And the Islamophobia, I just can't overstate what that has done in terms of the racial profiling of people, the use of language, the ways that people believe that they could say almost anything that was insulting to Arabs and to Muslims, and that there would be no consequence, that perhaps it was funny. In other cases, people didn't mean to be funny. They were quite serious. And that, again, that there would be no pushback. And for many of us who have seen various explosions of racial intolerance, this was not surprising, but it was nevertheless very unsettling. I guess the other thing I would say is that it's also the case that instead of the immediate aftermath of 9/11 being a moment to reflect on U.S. foreign policy and to understand the way the United States is viewed around the world was again another missed opportunity. You know, failure to really look at U.S. history. You know, yes, we were attacked by a criminal group and 3,000 people were killed that day. In 1965, the U.S. was directly involved in a coup in Indonesia that resulted over the course of a year in somewhere between 500,000 and 3 million people being killed by a government that the United States and Britain installed. 500,000 to 3 million people. This was an open act of state terrorism. Yet, to raise that, I remember raising this in the aftermath of 9/11, and there were people that were ready to lynch me for any suggestion that U.S. foreign policy has ever been criminal.
Bill Fletcher, it's always a pleasure to talk to you and hear your analysis, and I want to thank you so much for taking time with our listeners today.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so much for asking.
After this brief break, we'll be right back. We'll have a conversation with Nabil Aboud Ashkar, Palestinian violinist and peacemaker.